This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A state law that would shift power from the State Board of Education to the Ohio Governor's Office has been blocked from going into effect. A Franklin County judge issued a temporary restraining order just days after seven members of the State Board of Education filed a lawsuit claiming the new law is unconstitutional. In Kentucky, Democrats are arguing before the state Supreme Court that electoral maps drawn by Republicans in 2022 are unconstitutional. And in Indiana, the state's attorney general is facing a disciplinary complaint after comments he made on Fox News about a doctor who provided abortion care to a 10-year-old girl who was raped. It's the Weekly News Review today, and we've got news from across the tri-state to discuss. Joining me first to talk about news from Columbus is USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Anna Staver. Welcome back, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
We've talked with you before about this major overhaul of K-12 schools that Ohio lawmakers passed. First, explain how the system would change under this overhaul.
Sure. So it was passed as part of the state budget in June, and it really makes three changes. The first is it would change the Ohio Department of Education to something called the Department of Education and Workforce. And it would sort of create two silos within that agency, one for traditional K-12 schooling and one that would really focus on career technical education. And, you know, everyone seems to support that idea, that change. The second thing it would do is create a new director of that, the new Department of DEW. I like the acronym, Department of DEW. So there'd be the DEW director, and that would be a cabinet appointee who would report to Governor Mike DeWine. Now, the controversial change is that most of the State Board of Education's responsibilities, so they set curricula, they set statewide standards, they recommend textbooks, they talk about, you know, strategic plans, sort of the direction of public education in Ohio. That's controlled by the partially elected State Board of Education. Those duties would transfer from that board to that new DEW director. So essentially go from the board to the governor's office.
What was the argument behind these changes in the first place? What was motivating this to happen, you know, this year?
So this is something that governors have been trying to do for, you know, at least a decade or two. So it's not a new idea, but it was largely driven by the Republicans in the legislature who have been frustrated with the board over the last couple of years. So the last state superintendent, who's like the head of the board, resigned about 2 years ago, and we still don't have one. We've had a series of interim superintendents. And then the board has kind of gotten bogged down in some ideological debates that don't deal with statewide standards. Like, they've talked about transgender bathroom issues. They've talked about systemic racism, which would, and so they've like ended up in a lot of very political conversations over the last couple of years. And so the Republicans who supported this change said it was time to really focus on things like chronic absenteeism, pandemic learning loss, reading rates. And they think an appointee within the governor's office would do that better, perhaps.
And did this timing correspond at all to a greater number of Democratic-leaning members being elected to the state board?
Yeah, that is the argument, certainly, that we're hearing from the other side. So the governor gets to appoint about eight members. So it is a Republican-controlled board that, like, didn't change, if that makes sense.
Sure.
But, yeah, it was interesting timing. And then there's also this question of the State Board of Education is a partially elected body, right? And then it has public hearings. So parents can come in and talk about statewide standards, right? They have this, like, very direct voice in the creation. And there was some concern about whether we should be taking that away.
Now, seven members of the State Board of Education are suing over this change. What are they arguing in their lawsuit?
So they argue a couple of different things. The first is that the board was created by constitutional amendment. We've been talking a lot about constitutional amendments lately. So the people voted to create this separate board to handle education policy. And they say, you know, constitutionally created boards have certain core powers that you can't take away. So even though that amendment gave the legislature the ability to set what duties and responsibilities they have, is you can't reverse the will of the people to have this separate board. So that's sort of the constitutional argument. Then they have this second argument, which For those who hang around the state house a lot, we find it really interesting. It's called the single subject rule. And this is that legislation shouldn't have more than one subject. So you shouldn't get a bill that does 15 different things. And so they're arguing that the budget is about how we spend our money, not policy. And this was policy in the budget, and therefore it was passed incorrectly.
That is interesting. As I mentioned in the introduction, a Franklin County court judge issued a temporary restraining order Thursday. Explain what she did.
Yeah, so the law is supposed to go into effect on October 3rd. So, you know, the Ohio Department of Education wasn't waiting till October, right, to start. They've been interviewing for this new director. They've been, like, getting everything ready to make these changes, talking to potential new hires. And all of that came to a stop yesterday. So the judge issued a TRO, or a temporary restraining order. And that's only good for 14 days. But what it will get us to is we're going to have a hearing on October 2nd for an injunction. And that's the big hearing, because an injunction means let's put this law on hold sort of indefinitely while the court litigates. So if they were to be successful on October 2nd, it could delay implementation of this law by a year, 2 years, you know, however long it takes to get all the way to the state Supreme Court.
You talked with a lawmaker about this lawsuit. What did he tell you?
So Andrew Brenner, he's a lawmaker from here in the Central Ohio area, and he was instrumental in the drafting of this change. And he said that he thinks this is, well, he called it frivolous. And he said, you know, the Constitution gives the legislature the clear ability to decide what powers the board has, and this is what they have decided. So they didn't get rid of the board. They actually didn't take away all their power. The board would do teacher licensure revocation and territory transfers and disputes. So they had important work that they were left. And he feels as though the legislature was well within its bounds to do that.
And you had mentioned this was a constitutional amendment originally that created this board. What more does the state constitution say about all this and the work that the board should or could be doing?
Yeah, so the board actually was created back in 1953, so fun fact, and it says that there shall be a state board of education, so obviously you can't get rid of it without an amendment, but it also says that the powers and duties of the board and of the superintendent shall be prescribed by law, and this is where we're really getting into that divide, right? Does a constitutionally created board have certain core powers that you can't take away, even if the duties are prescribed by law?
And not everybody on the state board thinks this lawsuit will succeed, right?
Correct. I spoke with another board member. His name is John Hagen. And he, you know, he said, look, I don't like what the legislature did, but I think they were within their rights to do it.
And so what's next with this? Is October 2nd the next big date in this whole thing?
Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, what was interesting was yesterday, the judge decided right away. So sometimes, you know, judges take a while to issue a decision. So October 2nd, the restraining order will expire, but you can have it re-upped one time. So we could see another one for 14 days while the judge reaches a decision on the longer, more indefinite delay.
Interesting. Well, the Ohio Oil and Gas Land Management Commission also met this week to consider fracking under public land. There was major opposition to this, and protesters even broke into song. Anna, what was this commission supposed to be doing?
Yeah, so the Oil and Gas Land Management Commission is sort of tasked with setting the lease terms for leasing mineral rights, oil and gas exploration underneath public lands. So these parcels of land will essentially, at the end of the process, go up for bid, right? So oil and gas companies can say, here's what I would pay to have the mineral rights to this piece of land. But before they can go up for a bid, we have to decide the terms of the leases. So what we will and won't allow. And, you know, one of the things, for example, there's a wildlife area that is up for possible auction. And, you know, ODNR has asked that there be no drilling of any kind during hunting season and, you know, no commercial vehicles going on the roads in the wildlife area, no drilling, no surface activity. So no like well pads within 1,000 feet of the park. And so they're kind of deciding which one of those rules to keep and what not to keep before they put it out for a bid.
And ultimately, what did this commission decide to do?
So some of the public lands are owned by the Ohio Department of Transportation. There was 4 parcels, and these are like literal highways or rights of ways to highways. So if you're trying to connect, say, drilling from something, so a private piece of land on one side of the highway, and you want to run the pipe under the highway, you have to have the rights to do that. So they approved those 4 parcels, but they're not, I want to be clear, those were not state parks. Those were not wildlife areas. They were Ohio Department of Transportation. So they were highways and right-of-ways.
Okay.
There were another couple of parcels dealing with Salt Fork State Park, Zepernick Wildlife Area, and Wolf Run State Park, and they delayed deciding those. So they didn't reach any decision on the lease terms for the state parks. Okay.
And I know environmental groups were not happy with this outcome. Roxanne Groff with Save Ohio Parks spoke to WBNS about that.
Our campaign was to get denials on all the nominations, ODOT, the parks, the wildlife areas. So I'm not satisfied with that.
And you mentioned that the panel decided to delay the vote on the parks. The commission chair, Ryan Richardson, also spoke to WBNS about that decision to delay the vote. We have some audio from that.
It seemed like there were some concerns that we just needed additional time as a commission to discuss before we had a consensus.
And this all relates to changes made to Ohio state law. I think it was late last year, right?
Yeah. So this law about drilling underneath parks or leasing the lands has been on the books for more than a decade, but it's never been used. And so late last year, both in terms of the General Assembly and the literal hour of the day, Republicans decided to make a change that would make it harder for this commission, or if not impossible, some might argue, to say no to requests to lease lands under public parks for oil and gas exploration. So they set out a list of criteria, sort of 9 reasons why a commission could say no, but it didn't leave the door open to say no just because you sort of ideologically object to the idea of drilling under a state park.
So how much leeway does this Oil and Gas Land Management Commission really have?
Oh, that depends on who you ask. So like Roxanne Groff, who we just heard from, and some of those folks believe they have the ability to deny these. But when you talk to some of the commissioners, they say they don't see that kind of wiggle room. They see what the legislature did as a clear intent that they believe these lands need to go up for leasing.
And as I understand it, Roxanne Groff and that group, they don't want any kind of fracking or drilling under these state parks or wildlife areas. What does the Ohio Oil and Gas Association say in response to that?
Well, they argue that the concerns of the environmental groups are overblown. They say that this will be safe, that they can do this in a way that won't change the way visitors experience the parks. Now, obviously, the environmental groups have a lot of doubts about whether that's accurate. But what the Oil and Gas Commission says that's interesting is when you're drilling, you're not right underneath the lake bed. So, you know, the Utica Shale, like the lines where these oil and gas, like where the actual oil and gas is located, is sometimes thousands of feet underneath the surface. So these lakes are 50 to 100 feet deep in their deepest places. So you're drilling so far underneath that lake that even if there's a problem with the fracking right underneath the lake, it's unlikely that that would ever reach all the way back up, if that makes sense. Mm.
So what's next with all this?
So they have another meeting in October, and it sounds like we may actually get to hear the final terms of what would be required of anyone looking to lease, like Salt Fork and Wolf Run.
Okay. You also were covering the abortion ballot language this week, and there was a final decision about that language. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So first, I want to be absolutely clear that what would go into the Constitution, right, what the actual amendment language has not changed and it will not change. What did change is what will appear when you go to the voting booth. So the way the amendment is described when you go in and like see the screen got rewritten. And so it got rewritten in a way that the supporters of the amendment thought was unfair. They thought it was biased against the amendment, sort of encouraging people to vote no. So they went to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court mostly disagreed with them. They made one small change, but they allowed what we will see to read as things like unborn child instead of fetus. You won't see language about other kinds of reproductive rights outside of abortion, even though the amendment says things like IVF, birth control, miscarriage care.
And is that the language that petitioners will also need to circulate?
Well, I mean, we're going to have the vote. The circulation period is over, but there's going to be a large campaign push. I've already seen like very aggressive like text messages and emails and notices and social media campaigns to let people know if you are someone who supports the Reproductive Rights Amendment, they're trying to let people know that what they read on their screen when they go vote, in their opinion, is not accurate.
Gotcha. Okay. Sorry about that. I got myself all mixed up.
No worries.
It's a Friday.
It's also a long, confusing process to get on the ballot.
It is for sure. And the objections that the pro-abortion rights groups have to this language are the use of terms like unborn child instead of fetus and leaving out these other reproductive rights that would be in the amendment itself.
Right, right. Okay. So if we pass this in November, all of that language will go into the Constitution. It's just voters won't see it when they go to vote.
Okay. Okay. Well, and there's this, and this is a done deal. There's nothing else that the pro-abortion rights people can do to try to get this language changed?
Correct. It will be all about messaging now, because the ballots are going to go get printed pretty soon, because, as you know, voting starts, I believe early voting starts October 11th.
Yep, that sounds right to me. Well, thanks, Anna. I've been talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Anna Staver. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Up next, the Kentucky Supreme Court heard arguments on whether electoral maps drawn by Republicans in 2022 are unconstitutional. We'll hear about the case. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The Kentucky Supreme Court heard arguments earlier this week on whether electoral maps drawn by Republicans in 2022 are unconstitutional. Joining me now to talk about that case and other news from Frankfort is Louisville Public Media Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thanks for being here, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about this case before the Kentucky Supreme Court that relates to redistricting. Who brought the case before the court and why?
So the case was brought by the Kentucky Democratic Party. So in 2022, the GOP supermajority in Frankfort right now passed these several maps, and the Kentucky Democratic Party decided to challenge two of them. That would be for the House of Representatives and for the state's six congressional districts. So essentially, the Kentucky Democratic Party said that the two maps violated the Kentucky Constitution because there were partisan gerrymandering involved. They said that it was an unfair advantage to Republicans, and it made Democrats in the state's votes count less. And it's been going on since 2022. I'm pretty sure the Kentucky Democratic Party put in this lawsuit like the day after it passed, after the maps went into effect.
Well, and a lower court judge had ruled on this, right? What was that ruling?
Right. So last year, a lower court judge said that, yes, the maps are gerrymandered. They are politically gerrymandered. But he then went on to rule that nothing in the state constitution actually blocks the political maneuver, since roughly the population distribution within the maps were roughly equal. So each district did have a roughly equal population. And even though he said, yes, Republicans did cut up the map in a way that would benefit them and possibly make Democrats' votes count for less, they said that there's nothing in the Constitution that tells them they can't.
And I want to just be really clear. I know you mentioned that the Democratic Party is arguing that these maps have been gerrymandered, but what is their argument? How are they arguing that these maps violate the state's constitution? Gerrymandering does that?
Right, exactly. So there are a few sections in the state constitution that they're arguing under. One is Section 33. It has a set of rules that basically say how you can and cannot split up the different counties in the state when you're redistricting. It's a pretty complicated set of rules, but over the past, you know, century, it's kind of been diluted because the rules, while, you know, it's saying things like you can't try not to cut up counties as much as possible, don't combine multiple counties. Essentially, over the last century, the Supreme Court has ruled that those rules aren't really plausible. Like, you can't really enforce those rules and still have equal population. So they've been diluted over the years. And the Kentucky Democratic Party, it says that. They say, yes, it's true. You can't follow all these rules to the letter, but this map breaks them too frequently. They combine counties too frequently. They cut up counties too frequently. The pieces aren't contiguous enough. And so another section that they're arguing under is, and this is the more novel part of their argument, is that it violates the Free and Equal Elections Clause under the Kentucky Constitution. So they're saying that by cutting up the map in this way, you are not making the elections free and equal. Everybody's vote doesn't count equally, which is the more novel argument that the Kentucky Supreme Court has not ruled in favor of in the past.
I see. And you mentioned cutting up counties, but there are even some cities that are cut up in these maps, aren't there?
Definitely. That's one of the major issues. I mean, cities including Louisville, Covington, Bowling Green, Richmond, these are cities that have been really cut up in kind of the classic gerrymandering tactic, which is to combine some more Republican heavy centers like suburbs into these urban centers that are typically lean Democrat so that they become safer for Republicans overall.
What were the justices focusing on during this hearing in terms of the kinds of questions they were asking?
So there were a lot of different questions. And, you know, one of the issues that one of the justices brought up is in the congressional district map. There is one specific district that has been colloquially referred to as the Comer Hook. It refers to Republican Congressman James Comer, who represents what has historically been a very western part of the state. But more recently, the map has been changed to include this huge hook that goes up into the middle of central Kentucky to include both Monroe and Franklin counties, which are much more urban. Because that is partially where Congressman Comer resides. So, you know, the argument that Democrats are making is that it was just done to accommodate one congressman. And so, you know, one of the justices took a lot of offense at that, frankly. You know, he's from Western Kentucky. He took offense to the idea that someone wouldn't have enough pride to live in the district they represent. You know, another one of the justices focused on the idea that gerrymandering is not what it was, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, that technology has advanced to such a point that you can really pinpoint individual households to break up these maps in a way that really favors one party or another. But at the same time, there are other justices who are definitely a little bit more skeptical of the argument. You know, the court has never formalized that partisan gerrymandering is recognized under the Kentucky Constitution is illegal. So they really wanted to make sure that this is a part of the Constitution, that this is an accurate reading of the Free and Equal Elections Clause.
What did the state argue in defense of these maps?
So one of the arguments, and even though that lower court, they ruled that this is partisan gerrymandering, they made that determination of fact. There's still some arguments about whether or not it was really example of gerrymandering, but mostly what the state is arguing is that partisan gerrymandering is allowed in the Constitution, that this is really not something that the court should be involved in, that the court should not be litigating on whether or not a map is fair enough to different parties, and that they should stay out of the quote-unquote thicket of, you know, politics. And so they're arguing that the court should stay out of it, that the legislature has full power over this.
And I know your reporting referenced how Kentucky Democrats have been doing at the polls over the past 10 or 15 years. How have they been doing?
So, as I'm sure many people know, Democrats have suffered some pretty major losses just over the last decade. Right now, we have a supermajority of Republicans in both houses. And essentially, that was an argument of the state that, look, Democrats, you know, 10 years ago, you know, in 2012, got to make the map. They also, you know, according to the state, although they didn't offer evidence of this, the state was arguing that Democrats got to gerrymander 10 years ago, but that didn't lock in who wins, you know, a decade from that map. So they were basically arguing in some sense that, look, the party in charge gets to make the map. That's the rule, but it doesn't necessarily lock it in for the next 10 years. So they're kind of arguing to the court that it doesn't matter that much. Even if we are gerrymandering, it doesn't necessarily determine elections.
Interesting. They're kind of arguing they were losing anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. Secretary of State Michael Adams is a defendant, too. What did he say about all this?
So Secretary of State Michael Adams, did he agrees with his side of the, you know, obviously he's defended by the state.
Sure.
He agrees with everyone on his side of the table is what he said in that when we talked to him after the court hearing. And he basically agreed. He said that, you know, the court should stay out of it. This is a power of the legislature, and it should remain with them. It shouldn't be tempered except by some of the constitutional requirements that we already have in place, and by some, you know, federal requirements like the Civil Rights Act, or I mean the Voting Rights Act. So essentially making sure that there's not gerrymandering on racial lines, things like that. But he was saying, no, partisan gerrymandering is not covered under the state constitution, and the court should not rule in favor of the Democratic Party.
What exactly are the plaintiffs asking the court to do? What do they want to see the Supreme Court, you know, decide in all this?
So the Democratic Party is asking the Supreme Court to throw out the two maps and order the state legislature to try again. So that could mean a lot of things. You know, one of the questions we did ask the lawyer for the KDP is, are you worried that the map could get worse? And, you know, of course, the court is going to put certain restrictions if they were to rule in favor of the Democratic Party, put certain restrictions in place about how they need to break up the map. But it really would ultimately go back to the state legislature. And if the courts did order the legislature to try again, the new districts would have to be in place in time for 2024. So it wouldn't affect this year's election, which is a pretty major one, the gubernatorial election here in Kentucky. But it would affect 2024, and it might lead the courts or the legislature to extend candidate filing deadlines or to change voting dates if necessary.
And remind me, are Kentucky Supreme Court justices, I know they're elected, those are nonpartisan races, theoretically, aren't they?
Yes, they are theoretically nonpartisan, and they are elected, definitely. You know, it's always a question, is politics playing a part? You know, I just spoke with our Chief Justice. He has just announced that he's not running for re-election next year. He's only served one term, but he's decided that this will be his last. And, you know, I talked with him, frankly, about, you know, does partisanship play a role in the court? And of course, the answer is and should be no. You never know, though.
Sure. And is there a sense? I mean, in Ohio, there's always a sense of who are the more, you know, the Republican leaning justices, the Democratic leaning justices. Is there a sense of how that balance is on the Kentucky Supreme Court?
Sure. Yeah, there definitely is. You know, there's some swing votes, like the Chief Justice I just mentioned is often considered a swing vote. Although I'm reticent to say how this decision will go based on that. You know, it's always a bit of a toss up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can get in lots of trouble trying to predict what a judge or a justice is going to do. So what's next with all this in terms of timing and next steps?
You know, lately the Supreme Court has been taking their time. Like I mentioned, this redistricting process happened in 2022, lawsuit filed immediately after, and the lower courts, the circuit court, ruled last year. We've been waiting a while to get this in front of the Supreme Court, so not entirely sure when we'll have a decision. You know, presumably they'll want to do it before we start having filing deadlines, and obviously before the next legislative session, in case they do need to redraw those maps in January. But no, for right now, we're just kind of sitting on our hands and waiting.
There was another meeting earlier this week that I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about. There was the Kentucky Opioid Abatement Advisory Commission meeting. The panel there heard testimony about the use of a psychedelic treatment for opioid addiction. We don't have a ton of time left, but can you just tell us a little bit about that meeting?
Sure, I can just sum it up a little bit. So this is the second meeting in a process to decide if the state panel, this Opioid Abatement Advisory Commission, is going to invest $42 million out of a $900 million opioid lawsuit settlement fund to research Ibogaine, which is this kind of controversial treatment for opioid addiction and severe PTSD. It minimizes withdrawal symptoms. It is currently, however, classified as a Schedule I drug. It's not approved for any sort of distribution or treatment, but there seems to be some evidence that it is really effective in treating people with severe opioid addiction. And, you know, people went in front of this commission it was on Friday last week.
Oh, gotcha.
And talked about, you know, seeking help abroad. Like, people go to these clinics in Mexico and they come back, you know, saying that they're cured. People who thought that they would never, you know, live beyond their addiction. So it seems interesting. It seems promising. There are also some pretty significant potential drawbacks, you know, including there are some heart complications that have been associated with Ibogaine, slowed abnormal heart rhythms, things like that, that could be life-threatening. So anyways, that's really what's happening right now. And it's the first time that this drug may be receiving funding, receiving some research from a state government.
Yeah, such a fascinating process. I know you'll be following it, and we will be following your work. I've been talking with Louisville Public Media Capital reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you so much for your time today, Sylvia. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Up next, Indiana's Attorney General faces a disciplinary complaint. We'll hear why. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Indiana's Attorney General has sued the state's largest hospital system over its support for the doctor who provided abortion care to a young rape victim from Ohio. But now the AG faces a disciplinary complaint. Joining me in this recorded interview to walk us through what's been happening is Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thank you so much, as always, for having me on.
This all relates to a case that made national news, a 10-year-old girl who traveled from Ohio to Indiana for an abortion. Remind us of the details of that case.
Sure. Well, it started exactly as you said. So this is all coming out after the U.S. Supreme Court ended guaranteed abortion rights under the U.S. Constitution. Ohio had an abortion ban, one of the strictest in the country, that went into effect. It was what's known as a trigger law. So it was something that had been on the books already, but had been prevented from being enforced by the Supreme Court's guarantee of abortion rights, that once that ended, the law took effect. And so it banned abortion at 6 weeks or later. And this is the case of, as you said, a 10-year-old girl, obviously a rape victim when they're that young. And she was just over that six-week limit. And so a doctor in Ohio referred her to Indiana, where abortion had not yet been banned in any significant way following the Supreme Court's decision, and referred her specifically to a Dr. Caitlin Bernard, one of the state's primary providers of abortion care. There aren't, quite frankly, that many people in Indiana who provide abortion care, either before or after the state's near total ban took effect earlier this year. So this young girl travels to Indiana, is referred to Dr. Bernard, starts to see Dr. Bernard. The same time, Dr. Bernard attended a rally in downtown Indianapolis aimed at preserving abortion rights. She's been an outspoken advocate for abortion rights. She was discussing the case of this 10-year-old with a colleague and was overheard by a reporter from the Indianapolis Star, the newspaper here in town. And the reporter then asked Dr. Bernard about it. She discussed the case in a way that she thought preserved the patient's privacy. But as you said, it made national headlines. It was an example, a concrete example of the sort of impact that abortion bans can have on actual people. And so it, the president talked about it. It was all over national news. And Todd Rokita went on cable news to say, I'm looking into this. This doctor is has a history of not reporting these incidents, which is not true, by the way, and said that he would be investigating Dr. Bernard. And that's when the ball started rolling on something that ultimately hasn't been resolved in a lot of ways until earlier this year and is still ongoing, as you point out, with another lawsuit from the attorney general and now a disciplinary complaint filed against him.
Well, and I want to walk through some of these steps because it has been very complex since that initial story broke. My understanding is that in November, the Indiana Attorney General filed a complaint with the state's medical licensing board. What was the nature of his complaint against this doctor?
Well, he alleged a number of things. One, that she didn't properly report the abortion as required by law, that she didn't properly report the abortion to child welfare authorities as required by law in the case of an abortion performed on someone under the age of 16. But then there were also allegations about Dr. Bernard not following privacy laws. Now, the Medical Licensing Board unanimously rejected the more serious charges that Rokita leveled against Dr. Bernard about, not following the law as it comes to reporting or speaking with the authorities. But it did ultimately decide that it felt like Dr. Bernard had said one too many sort of identifying enough details about this girl as to violate state and federal privacy statutes, and so gave her a reprimand, just a letter that says, we think this was wrong, don't do it again. It did not in any other way sanction her. She is allowed to continue practicing without restriction. Both sides kind of counted this as a win. Obviously, Dr. Bernard wasn't happy with the ultimate result in being reprimanded, but disagreed that she had violated the patient's privacy. And it is important to note that the girl herself has never been identified by anyone in the media or publicly, as far as we're aware. But the Dr. Bernard celebrated the fact that the more serious charges against her were discounted entirely by the Medical Licensing Board, while Todd Rokita celebrated in that he at least got her reprimanded by the board for violating privacy. So both sides kind of claimed victory, even if neither of them got what they wanted.
Hmm. And now Attorney General Rokita is suing the hospital system where this doctor works, right? What's the basis of that lawsuit?
Well, I think whether there is a basis for the lawsuit will be something the courts decide. What Todd Rokita is saying is that it really ties to it's IU Health, which is the state's largest healthcare provider that employs Dr. Bernard. He's saying that IU Health's support of Dr. Bernard throughout this process, and it has been supportive, immediately after the sort of allegations against Dr. Bernard were leveled by, among others, Todd Rokita about violating privacy, the system said, we've done our own review of the case to determine if there was any privacy violated. We don't feel that there has been. After the Medical Licensing Board's ruling earlier this year, IU Health came out with a statement in support of Dr. Bernard and said it still disagrees that she violated privacy. And Todd Rokita is using those statements to go after IU Health, saying, oh, well, the fact that you're not agreeing with the Medical Licensing Board, you're undermining the Medical Licensing Board, and that's going to create confusion among your workforce. So I'm trying to put an end to that. It's also saying that by Dr. Bernard betraying, violating the privacy statutes, well, then IU Health, as her employer, has too. Again, I don't know where that's going to go. I'm not an attorney, certainly, but that is at least how he's choosing to file this lawsuit.
But the Indiana Supreme Court's Disciplinary Commission has taken issue with the Attorney General. Explain what's going on with that.
Yeah, so anyone can complain about an attorney's conduct in the state of Indiana. You make that complaint to the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission, which is a group not made up of the Supreme Court justices, the five justices, but of people who work for them. And they look into attorney and judicial complaints about judges all the time. Most of those never see the light of day. Either the complaints aren't really verified, that they find that there's really no wrongdoing according to the rules of conduct for judges or attorneys, and that's the last we hear of them. Occasionally, the Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission does file a formal complaint. It says, we've looked into these complaints that we received, and we find that, yes, this attorney or this judge should be disciplined, and here's why we think that is. And then there's a process that plays out that can include a hearing before what's called a hearing officer in the case of of attorney discipline, which is usually like a former judge or former justice. And then ultimately the Indiana Supreme Court takes a recommendation from that hearing officer and decides whether or not to discipline the attorney. What we're in right now is the Disciplinary Commission has filed a formal complaint. It said that Todd Rokita violated both rules of professional conduct for attorneys and state law, which this has been a complicated legal process. But at one point last year, there was a lawsuit filed by Dr. Bernard against Todd Rokita trying to stop his investigation. And a judge in that case ultimately ruled for Rokita because he then filed with the Medical Licensing Board. And the judge said, well, it's out of my hands now. But that judge, in her opinion, wrote, Todd Rokita violated state law by discussing the investigation into Caitlin Bernard before he had gone to the Medical Licensing Board. And under state law, you're supposed to keep those things confidential. And by saying that she was on cable news, saying that she was someone with a history of failure to report, which she's not, I mean, it's pretty easy to look at her record for anyone in the public to look at her record, and she clearly isn't. But by saying those things, that he was prejudicing any case that might be brought against her, which is against the rules of professional conduct. So that's what the complaint against Todd Rokita is. The most likely outcome here is, like I said, it will go to a public hearing in front of a hearing officer. And then from there, a hearing officer makes a recommendation to the Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court ultimately decides what, if anything, to do with Todd Rokita.
As you mentioned, part of the disciplinary complaint centers around these comments that Attorney General Rokita made on Fox News.
We have this abortion activist acting as a doctor with a history of failing to report. So we're gathering the information, we're gathering the evidence as we speak, and we're going to fight this to the end.
And I just want to make sure I'm clear. Are you saying that the state Supreme Court's Disciplinary Commission takes issue with these comments because they came before he had filed that complaint with the medical board? I mean, what I want to make sure I understand what they're saying was wrong with these comments.
It's a twofold issue. One, by saying what he said, he is, according to the complaint, prejudicing essentially. I'm not sure if I'm even saying that word right, but He is unduly influencing any case that might be brought against Dr. Bernard in the public sphere. But also state law, that's a rule of professional conduct in Indiana. But under state law, when there is a doctor, for instance, who is the subject of an investigation by the Attorney General's office, they are not supposed to make that public. It is supposed to remain confidential until a complaint is filed by the Attorney General's office with the Medical Licensing Board. And at the time that Todd Rokita made those comments on Fox News, he was months away, literally months away from filing that official complaint with the Medical Licensing Board.
Yeah, I see. How has Attorney General Rokita defended his remarks?
The same way he defends everything, which is steadfastly and loudly. He says, you know, first of all, he uses the rhetoric of he's fighting to preserve, you know, the rights of the unborn, and that he's always going to be a fighter on behalf of babies and things like that. That's been his rhetoric going back to his time as a congressman years ago. That's who he is as a politician. more specifically to these charges, he argues that, well, for one, as a public official, he was just doing his job, that, you know, he has to discuss these sorts of things in public because the public wants to know about them. He also claims that Dr. Bernard gave up any right to confidentiality by first speaking to the Indianapolis Star about this case, which kicked off everything. That's not really how the law works, but we'll see if that argument holds up. And then he also tries to make an argument that he's, as it is in the state law, that it bars employees of the Attorney General's office from discussing these things publicly. He argues he's not an employee of the Attorney General's office. He is the Attorney General, and that makes him different. Again, it's an interesting argument. We'll see what it ultimately leads to. But that's sort of been the three prongs he's used so far.
Okay. It sounds like a big part of that is kind of him doubling down on being an opponent of abortion rights.
I mean, Todd Rokita has never not doubled down on almost anything he's done.
Okay. Now, do I understand correctly, too, that the doctor involved in this case has filed a defamation suit against the Attorney General?
He did a long time ago. That was part of this, if I remember correctly, it was part of this effort to stop this investigation by the Attorney General that she felt was meritless at the time before it went to the Medical Licensing Board. A lot of that is just not been litigated in any sort of way yet. So I think it feels like a long way off from being resolved.
Okay. And you said it sounds like the next thing that could happen is this Supreme Court disciplinary case could have a public hearing of some kind?
Yeah. So technically, both sides can come to some sort of settlement. That seems pretty unlikely in this case between the disciplinary commission and Todd Rokita. It would certainly seem like he would fight this tooth and nail to the end of the process. But it is technically possible. But yeah, the most likely thing here is a hearing before a hearing officer. And I guess it's worth noting that this is the second attorney general in a row of Indiana who has been brought before the Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission. The previous attorney general, Curtis Hill, who was defeated for re-election by Todd Rokita at the Republican convention in 2020, he was ultimately... his law license was ultimately suspended by the Indiana Supreme Court for criminally battering four women. Oh.
Well, Brandon, thank you for your time. I've been talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. We always appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical directors are Ella Rowan and Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Thank you.